The Unshackled Waves, episode 256.
Broadcasting from Melbourne, Australia, this is The Unshackled Waves with Tim Wills, brought to you by theunshackled.net.
Hello everyone, welcome to another Waves episode. The UK has a new Prime Minister after the members of the Conservative Party elected by a margin of 2-1 Boris Johnson as their new leader to replace Theresa May. There is now a lot of optimism that as a Brexit supporter he can deliver what the British people voted for in 2016 and the UK can leave the European Union by October 31st. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinta Ardern visited Australia last week to give a speech at Melbourne's Town Hall on good governance and met with Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews to discuss her well-being budget. But Ardern failed in a diplomatic mission with the Morrison government not backing down on its policy of deporting New Zealand-born criminals from Australia. The Adam Goods documentary, The Final Quarter, about the booing saga in the final years of his career, premiered on Network 10 last week. The media narrative now is that the booing was racially motivated, but that is only because Goods, once he became Australian of the Year, labelled Australia as racist. This led to resentment from AFL fans and the booing began. MasterChef judge George Calambaras has admitted to underpaying workers at his chain of restaurants to the tune of $7.83 million. He was fined $200,000 by the Fair Work Commission. There was a lot of pressure on Network 10 to sack him from the show, but in the end, all judges are leaving the show because, ironically, they believe they weren't being paid enough despite being on million-dollar salaries. To digest all these stories is, once again, the senior editor of The Unshackled, Damien Ferry. Damien, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
Now, the UK has a new Prime Minister. Well, they should have been the Prime Minister 3 years ago. Boris Johnson was elected by the Conservative Party members in the UK to replace Theresa May after she announced that she would be stepping down back in May after three attempts to pass her negotiated Brexit deal did not go through Parliament. So this was quite a grueling process to elect a replacement because there were five ballots of Conservative Party MPs whittling it down to a final two, which was Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt, who is a moderate in the Conservative Party. He supported the Remain campaign during the 2016 Brexit referendum, but it was a pretty convincing win from the members to Boris Johnson. He won with 92,000 votes to Jeremy Hunt's 46,000. So a 2-1 victory gives him a strong mandate against the naysayers and the Stop Boris faction in his party. And finally, we hope that he can deliver Brexit, deal or no deal, by October 31st.
That's right. I mean, I'm hoping that that's the case as well. He's won a resounding victory within his own party. Their members have voted for him. He's somebody that's always been a popular face, a love it or hate it type of person, and somebody that will hopefully bring some change. I mean, a lot of people, at least within the nationalist camp, are sceptical, but in saying that, at the very least, we have somebody that is serious about bringing on Brexit and taking us out, or taking themselves out, so to speak, of the EU, deal or no deal, which really is what it should be. I mean, I personally think that they should be exiting the EU with no deal because that's what people voted for. A deal to me is a compromise. It isn't what people wanted. People no longer want the EU to be a shadow behind them. They want to rule and be a national sovereign nation, and to continue to be able to do what they do best. And this is what people want. There is a big divide within the public, within Britain. So it will be interesting to see how it all plays out.
Well, they were supposed to leave the European Union back in March, but Theresa May missed that deadline. So it got extended to October 31st. But the deal she negotiated with the European Union, it was considered Brexit in name only because the UK would be largely bound by most of the EU regulations that the UK public voted to leave in 2016, so it didn't satisfy the hard Brexiteers in her party, and because the UK courts said that the Parliament had to vote on the final Brexit deal, that complicated the process because the Conservatives don't have a majority and the Labour Party's divided. Under Corbyn, they're supporting Brexit, but under certain conditions. So it was messy. But you hope now that Boris Johnson, elected with such a strong mandate from the party base, that these leftover Remainers in the Conservative Party, and Theresa May herself was a soft Remainer, hence why she didn't go for the full Brexit, but they fall into line now that the base of the party wants a hard Brexit. They've elected Boris Johnson to do it, fall into line and make sure that you fulfill what the British people voted for.
Yeah, that's what it's all about at the end of the day. I mean, people want to have these politicians deliver what was voted on. I mean, this happened over 3 years ago. I remember it quite well because on the weekend that it happened was when my daughter was born. So I remember it being in the paper at the time. It was a very big big result and a big issue. And for 3 years, this could have been resolved already and be done with, but they continue to talk about it and have little action. I mean, this could have been an issue that as the vote occurred straight after it, they should have put it in place. And it was really a shame that they had to get Parliament to vote on it, because when that sort of situation occurs, it makes it very difficult to get the amount of votes needed. And I think that's what the problem is there, having to get everybody to sign, not only in other parties but also in your own, when everybody had different views of what a Brexit should look like. So I'm just hoping that they get on with the job. And I mean, I think it will motivate other countries to go the same way. We've already seen other countries within Europe, very anti-EU parties, get up and become even ruling parties, for instance, in Hungary and Italy. So we're really seeing a movement here because of people rejecting this kind of, I guess you could say, a globalist, authoritarian sort of regime, which is what the EU is, telling all these nations how to run their own countries and having this power dictating all these particular issues. And I think people just really want to embrace their own identity and be able to rule their countries without any external influence.
And if the UK political class thought that they could just shift Brexit off to the side and not implement it and the public wouldn't notice, they were mistaken. Because of the Brexit delay, it meant that the UK participated in the European parliamentary elections back in May, and the Brexit Party came first with over 30% of the vote, and the Conservative and Labour parties, which are in the House of Commons fighting over the Brexit deal, they got decimated in the vote. And so that was a reminder to the politicians that you've got to deliver Brexit. I mean, Nigel Farage, like last year, UKIP was falling apart and Nigel Farage left and set up the Brexit Party. It was a party that was less than 1 year old, yet came first in the European UK elections. That's a pretty stunning achievement.
It is, and people want to get this issue out of the way and solved. And I think it was a great result to have a third party, a third force, be able to claim such a victory in the European elections. And it will be seen as to the elections coming up in the next couple of years, whenever that is to occur, how they would face there now that Boris Johnson is PM, whether they would have that same sort of resounding victory or whether they will be pushed back and not be able to get as many votes because of the leadership change. But at the end of the day, people have to realise that regardless of consequences, and the consequences are very far, well, very, very little, I would say, but people just have to get this done. I mean, that's what they want. And, you know, I mean, if Scotland or Northern Ireland have an issue with it and they want to part, then so be it. I mean, really, it just, at this point, people have to focus on what their constituency, what their people have voted for, and that's what they voted for, and that's what they have to deliver.
Boris Johnson, he's commonly referred to as the UK's Trump. The most obvious example is Boris Johnson has quite a elaborate hairstyle like Trump, but they're both flamboyant and showmen in their public persona. Boris Johnson has had a colourful personal life, and before he was a politician, he was a journalist, and so he's been in the public eye for over 30 years, like Trump. And Boris Johnson was Trump's choice to become the new prime minister. And if you had a look at Boris Johnson's victory speech, it was classic Boris, where he's like, this isn't, we're not in a crisis. He spoke about where we're going to energize Britain, because his campaign slogan was deliver Brexit, unite the country and defeat Labour. Which the acronym was DUD, and so he added energize at the end for it to be DUDE. And so he was like, this is going to be an exciting time, we're going to deliver tax cuts, we're going to build the infrastructure, to we want to unite the party, you know, there's so much opportunity for us leaving with the EU. It was a classic classic as I said, Boris. He put on a show, delivered lots of character to it, and well, it's a refreshing from Theresa May's bland style.
Yeah, she was a very bland character, didn't really have much personality, and I think people didn't really warm up to her when it comes. So, I mean, people have to understand that it's not only someone's ideological positioning within a party and in politics, but also whether people can actually warm to who you are as a person. And that's something that she wasn't able to achieve. And he has been able to achieve that. And I think it shows a lot, and I think it's a good thing that we have politicians now that are your love it or hate it type of politicians. I think we need more of them, because they're the type of people that stand for something, or at the very least have more principles within their ideological sort of framework. And when you have politicians that are very in the middle and, you know, can drift either way and get a bit of support from here, a bit of support from there, those people there don't really believe in anything. They're career politicians. And that's not what we need right now. I think we're over that. And I think we need people that you either love them or hate them. That really shows that that person has a strong ideological stance, whether you support it or not. And I think that's what is needed in politics.
Well, if the left are triggered by your election as leader, then obviously there must be something good to you, because, well, Boris, he's said many politically incorrect things over the years, which the left have been quite triggered over. He described gay men as bum boys and women in the burqa as something that you put a letter in, comparing them to a letterbox. I mean, he has, like, the UK is probably one of the most politically correct anti-free speech countries in the West, but he's managed to get away with saying some colourful things, and so there is hope in that regard.
There is, and I think what people have to also understand is that not only is it very important that we have candidates that are very anti-PC and that basically speak in the same way that someone would speak at a pub. I think that's how you relate to people, to be able to speak like a normal person rather than a robot. And also another thing to add is that once you come out and say some things that are deemed controversial or not mainstream like he has, the worst thing you could do is to buckle down and basically come out and apologise and say that for whatever reason you were drunk at the time and this and that, and you weren't able to articulate what you were saying, because that ultimately makes you admit defeat, and it basically ruins your career. A lot of people think that by doing that they're able to then get back in the game, but it actually damages a profile. It really does, and we've seen it so often when people do this. People lose respect over these sort of people. Even if they're people that they don't really agree with, if you see people that are principled, and even when put under pressure, they say, yeah, you know, I stand by what I said and I don't care, then they can't really attack you any further. They can continue to say, oh, this person is mean, but at the end of the day, that's beyond what they can do. It just makes you look like a principled person, regardless of what principle it is, and people do have respect for that. But if you do buckle down and give in, then that will destroy you. And I think we have seen time and time again with people like Annie, with other people, that when they were put under pressure, they didn't admit defeat. They were very strong in their stance and never backed down. And that's why they were very popular with voters. People were able to relate to that. They didn't want people that were basically puppets, you know. They wanted people that would be able to go up there, speak their minds and not care, because that is how the normal person, the average person is. They within a household, within a group of friends, for instance, and so forth, they are able to talk to them without a PC sort of filter. And I think that's what we need in our representatives as well.
Well, Boris Johnson, we've known what he's stood for. As I said, he's been in the public eye for 30 years. He told us what he wants to do as Prime Minister. Now comes the big challenge. Can he implement it, given Britain's fractured political culture? That is the big thing. We know what he's promised. Now comes the ultimate test. So obviously we're wishing him the best of luck. And well, if he can't save the UK and get it out of the EU, then I don't think anyone can.
That's right. I mean, with the amount of coverage that this sort of topic has got over the last couple of years, you'd expect this really to boil over and come to a conclusion. I hope it does, because I'm sick of hearing about it in the news. And we want results. Ultimately, we want results. We want to know what's going on. And we want the people to have their verdict that they decided at the ballot box actually be put in writing and be counted. The worst thing is when you have politicians that continue to vote against the interests of the people, because it goes against their personal interests, and that's not what representatives should be doing. They should be representing the people and doing what is right, and I think that it is right to exit the EU, and they should continue to go down that line and make sure that it happens.
Australia's left, well, they were in a form of heaven last week when their poster girl, Jacinta Ardern, visited Melbourne. She was invited by the Lord Mayor, Sally Capp, to give a speech about good governance, and she got to meet her, well, progressive counterpart in Australia, Premier Daniel Andrews, who wanted to discuss with her wellness budget, which, well, forget about budgets being about economic responsibility and fiscal discipline. It's all about social justice, mental health, homelessness. You know, who cares about surpluses and deficits? Now, in her speech, she obviously sees herself as the antithesis of Donald Trump. She said, you can either choose to capitalize on fear, stoke it, and politically benefit from it, or you can run a counter narrative. You can talk about hope. You can talk about solutions to the problems. And as the MC for that speech said, there was 2,000 people in Melbourne's town hall, fanboys and fangirls. I thought that was pretty accurate fawning over these motherhood statements that she, you know, gives out. It just makes you want to vomit.
I mean, she's another character, at least, where. One thing I will say is that, like Boris, but on the other opposite side, she is a love it or hate it person too. So I think that is good that we are able to have these type of characters that are very one-sided, though it is on the wrong side in my view. But yeah, I mean, what would you expect? I mean, the people that are going to go visit her are of a particular background. You know, you're very typical Melbourneian sort of CBD upper class elite. Her ideology, I would say, is has very little difference to Daniel Andrews. So I think they would have been a very closely ideological couple there. I mean, she has really done a lot of damage in her own country. I mean, she's used a tragedy to basically, therefore, go after people's weaponry, their guns, their right to arms, use that as an excuse to be able to do so. And not only that, economic details, of course, and many other things, virtue signaling to minority groups, which is something that we see all the time when left-leaning leaders are in place. We've seen all this sort of happening before, and it's just getting worse. And I think another thing to note is that she really is the exact opposite of what somebody that would see themselves as a traditional sort of conservative person would be. I mean, she's someone that really has always put that out there.
Yeah, you're right that, well, any world leader exploits a tragedy for political advantage. But Jacinda Ardern, post the Christchurch massacre, she's used that to pursue an anti-freedom agenda. You mentioned the gun control, which is in its second phase now, which is registering all firearms in New Zealand, basically cataloguing, you know, who are the firearm owners and where are they keeping them, really Big Brother stuff. And then there was the crackdown on free speech post the massacre, where the ISPs were forced to censor websites in New Zealand. You had New Zealand security visiting people at their houses where if they'd posted something that was in support of Donald Trump. Basically, that was going to be a sign of extremism. Let's not forget that a man who shared the mosque shooting video, he was sentenced to 21 months in prison just for that act of sharing it. And so there's quite sinister things going on in New Zealand. And you have to remember that the most outrageous thing about her being in the position of Prime Minister is that she's propped up by a self-proclaimed nationalist in Winston Peters, who chose to make her Prime Minister over the Conservative National Party in New Zealand. And he said, yes, we'll crack down on free speech. Yes, we'll crack down on guns. He's just basically said, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, that's an interesting point there. First of all, in reference to the person that shared the video, that is quite scary that someone could get so much jail time simply for sharing a violent a video online. Now, I mean, you have to put this into perspective here. Why is it this tragedy is seen as somehow a lot worse than any other tragedy that has happened? Even tragedies that have happened on a bigger scale are just, you know, not even talked about in the media. I mean, on that same week that happened, we also had, many Christians in Nigeria that were slaughtered. We had bombings in Palestine and Israel, for instance. There was even a church attack in the Philippines. I mean, I remember this was all happening at the same time as Christchurch, yet the media was all onto Christchurch and nothing else seemed to be of importance. And not only that, there's violent content all over the internet. I mean, you could look up ISIS beheadings any day of the week if you wanted to and watch them without any problem. Not that I would advise people to be looking that kind of content up, but it's there if you wanted to watch it. Yet, that's not a jailable offence, but this is. So what's the difference there? Why is this so much worse? And second of all, with Winston Peters, that is a very big disappointment, because you expect more out of a nationalist leader. I'm not sure if he was looking at it simply that he may have had some ideological ties on economics, being a nationalist and a Labor Party that might have had some similar views there. But with all the damage there, and especially with Ardern, which is a very progressive left leader and not one of your old school type of Labor leaders, it doesn't seem to be a match. I don't know why he went for that option. I'm still trying to think about what could have been that triggered that. I do know that you had mentioned earlier that maybe it was just because he wanted to be the acting PM for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, Jacinda Ardern was on maternity leave. She was away for 6 weeks, and so Winston Peters, well, He's a career politician, and so even if it's only for 6 weeks, get to be acting prime minister, that's good enough for him to sell his party and the country short.
Well, that's right, but I mean that is selling it a lot short. I mean, I don't see anything that has happened in New Zealand over the past year or two. I don't think any nationalist politics has happened at all. I really don't, and I don't know what Winston Peters, apart from that, has got it out of this, because none of his party policies have been implemented. I don't see him having any influence on the Labor Party agenda. So it's a real shame, you know, it really is. I think people were expecting more, and unfortunately they're disappointed in it.
Well, the only voice of reason left in the parliament is David Seymour, who's the lone ACT MP, which is ACT as the Libertarian Party in New Zealand. He's the only one who's voted against these gun control measures and is standing up for free speech. Now, Libertarian parties, they sort of tread very carefully on things such as this, but David Seymour, he's been adamant that freedom must be protected post-Christchurch.
Well, that is an important issue, and I'm glad that somebody is standing up for that that freedom, because it is really an important issue. And one thing that I do take from this that is actually interesting and comforting is that a lot of people have chosen to not hand their weapons in, and only a very, very little amount of people have. So that is something that I can actually look with content and say, well, it looks like people have learned, especially since this kind of effect happened over in Port Arthur, only, 1996, so 23 years ago. So people in Christchurch, because it's happened before, they were able to look at what went on and how it worked and said, well, this isn't for us. I know what the consequences of this are. And we called it straight away. As soon as Christchurch happened, we knew straight away, yep, this is going to be a gun control inflicting a government now that's going to go on a warpath on guns. We just knew that this is what was going to happen. So in saying that, I mean, it was kind of shocking that they went down that route, because I would have thought that because of it happening previously, that they would have come to the conclusion that many people would have predicted it and that it wouldn't have been a surprise. And so in that sort of fact, I would have thought that it would be a silly option to go with because of that. That there would have been a lot of hostility that was people were expecting it. Unlike with Port Arthur, that was a different situation. There was a lot of people that were combating that sort of action and was going against it. But because it hadn't happened previously, we weren't able to look to other countries and say, okay, this is a country that went down that particular path. Whereas New Zealand and Australia are very connected by location and culture and so forth. And for it to happen only 23 years ago, a lot of people living in New Zealand would have remembered it and would have said, okay, this is a similarity here that I know what's going on. I'm not going to hand my gun in for the a couple hundred dollars or whatever the government's going to pay me to hand it in. It's not worth it based on these freedoms that you speak of that are very important to a lot of people. I think it's great that people have stood up and not handed it in. And yeah, you know, it looks like that the government, sooner or later, especially the way Ardern is going, is that they're going to send SWAT teams busting in, house by house, trying to search for guns, because at this rate, they're not really getting any.
Now, Jacinda Ardern, she didn't just come to Australia to speak with the Melbourne Loveys. She was also on a diplomatic mission. She wanted to speak with Scott Morrison to object to Australia's new policy since 2014 of deporting criminals who are non-citizens who happen to be citizens of New Zealand. Now, she described this as a corrosive aspect of the relationship, but Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton said, we're going to put Australia first, we want to protect our nation from pedophiles. Anthony Albanese, he was actually on the Today Show when Peter Dutton said this. Albanese said, yeah, we think that the balance is right with this policy. And ScoMo said, like, look, this is nothing against New Zealand, like, we deport all non-citizen criminals, regardless of whether they come from New Zealand or any other place. And so she came back from New Zealand empty-handed. Both Australian major parties said, no, we want to get rid of these criminals, because any country, if you can get rid of the criminals in your country by deporting them somewhere else, you're going to do it. And so why not do it? If you can get rid of them away from your citizens forever, then that's a good thing. And so Jacinda Ardern, when she was interviewed by Lisa Wilkinson on the Sunday Project, and she was asked about calling up corrosive, she was sort of like, oh, I didn't mean to play the tension there. We were just speaking frankly as friends, because we're such our good friends. We can have this open conversation. There's no real tension. And so she basically conceded defeat, and that Australia was having none of that.
Well, I think she was very smug, very cocky in their approach in that, how she went to the media and basically, corrosive relationship there, and how such an issue, which really, I mean, when it comes down to it, you think, how is this an issue at all? I mean, really, it's nothing. Yet she tried to elevate and dramatise something that has no importance. I mean, like you said, it's important for a country that if we have criminals here and they are from New Zealand, to send them back. I think that's a fair policy to have. And likewise, if it's the other way around, I'm sure they would do the same, and they would send Australians back to over here if they were causing havoc over on their shores. So really, I don't understand why it was an issue. The way that she went on about it in media, I mean, I'm sure there was a lot more different topics of conversation that could have been had that was more relevant to what people are facing, and they could have spoken on multiple topics, but not something this small, that really played nothing. And I think the leader should have went at it a little bit harsher, I think, because the way that she tried to embarrass our government, I think they should have really put it to task and gone on the media and spoken a bit harshly about her and made her out to be a fool, rather than sort of, played it off and tried to make it go down and I think they should have really went at her a little bit harder. That's my thoughts on that.
Well, it was quite fitting that on her way back to New Zealand, her New Zealand Defence Force charter flight, it actually broke down and was grounded, and so she had to catch a commercial flight back. But I think by the end of it, we're all pleased to see her go home. And, despite this poll that was put out by, it was called the Believability Index, was said that Jacinda Ardern was the most trusted politician in Australia at 77%, above all our politicians. I think after how she embarrassed herself this week, we're all happy for her to go home and her to go back to New Zealand, and glad that she's not our Prime Minister.
Well, I think after recent times, we could put to rest that polls are really not as factual as we make them out to believe. I just really don't see that. I don't see that much of a crowd behind her. I mean, sure, you're going to have that, especially, from the Green type of class, people that vote that particular way would love her. I mean, no doubt about it. But the majority of people from the Conservative wing, also plus old school sort of Labourites, more nationalist sort of inclined, types, I think, wouldn't like her either way. So I reckon that she would have a small following. I don't think it's a big following at all, because she's very radical. I think that's the way it is. And anyone that is actually against that policy approach, I mean, I would be happy to invite them to volunteer to hold these criminals in their own houses and see how they would like it. And we've spoken on this issue so many times. I mean, same with immigration, mass immigration. They advocate for it, yet they don't want them in their suburbs. They want them in the poor areas where, then those people have to put up with them and deal with them. I mean, we see that countless, amount of times. And I mean, we used to talk about it with Malcolm Turnbull and others that lived in really high class areas, and you never get any immigrants or any criminals or anyone in that really clean areas, non-violent areas, but then they're all shipped to the working class neighbourhoods, and then they have to then go through all the trouble and stuff that they have to go through. And then that's where the big divide is. I mean, if you're not willing to put your hand up and accept these type of people in your own house, then why should you force it on anybody else and force other people to take them in? And it's just such a hypocritical stance to have.
I managed to bring myself to watch the Adam Goods documentary, The Final Quarter, which was on Network 10 last Thursday. Now, this documentary, it was about the end of his career, the booing saga. It didn't offer any new analysis, exclusive footage or interviews. It was simply a whole bunch of media clips beginning in 2013 when he singled out that 13-year-old girl who called him an ape up until the end of his career, where in his last games he was booed ferociously every time he got the ball. And it was followed by a special episode of The Project afterwards where Waleed Ali was joined by AFL Indigenous advocates and sports journalists, where they all said, oh yes, this was a shameful episode. Adam Goods was racially booed out of the game. It was so terrible for Australia as a whole. That's the consensus now, because the AFL put out an apology in advance saying we should have done more at the time to stop the booing. But it's important to go through, because it does go through what started it all, which was this 13-year-old girl who called him an ape, who he singled out in the crowd, and she was taken away from, I think she was with her grandmother, to an interrogation room where I don't know what was said there, but that's pretty scary for a 13-year-old to. I thought the left was against family separation, but yeah, she was treated basically like she was some sort of terrorist, and then the next day, Adam Goods said she was the face of racism in Australia. Now, the left, they say, oh, but Adam Goods said, oh, it wasn't her fault, I don't want to be victimized, but he basically said, Adam Goods, that she's a representative of, like, original sin, like racism, that Australians say are racist, it's born into us from the time that we are born, and this girl is the example of it, basically saying, you know, she's the perfect example of being raised a racist. So she was singled out, she was, you know, put up as this is what's wrong with Australia.
Yeah, she was. I mean, and she was singled out because of the colour of her skin. And the worst thing about it, like you mentioned, was that she was so young, 13 years old. Now, she's over at a game. It's quite common for people that really get involved in a match of some sort, no matter what the sport is, to taunt the other opponents. I mean, this is something that happens quite often. And it seemed to be the spirit of the game that people do this, to get really involved. Because otherwise it's no different to watching it at home on TV. I mean, when people go in there, they really want to feel like they're part of it. So when you have a teenager there, innocent teenager, and she's, calling someone an ape, I mean, really, now when people come out and say that that's a racist term, then they're implying that somehow apes are connected to Aboriginal people. So that's a racist thought in the first place.
Well, you have to remember at the time that Adam Goods, like, he had a beard and he's got, like, black hair. So, like a lot of people pointed out that, well, forget about his race. Like, any man who sort of has, like, a lot of, like, facial hair, like, is hairy all over, like, they're often, like, called a gorilla or whatever. I remember Jason Dunstall, who was the Hawthorn player. If he's white, he was referred to as the chief, and commonly referred to as an ape because of the way that he was built. Jason Dunstall's white. Nobody objected to that at the time.
That's right, and it's common. Like I said, I mean, if someone is hairy, I mean, that's an observation that you make, and apes tend to be hairy, of course, so that is something that you connect the dots there. And people can make that observation that it's a very similar, that someone that's hairy looks like an ape. It's nothing to do with race, I don't think. And, I mean, to imply that it does is to basically put that stereotype out there. I mean, this is what I mean, that the left, when they complain about racism, and that they're basically causing a lot of it themselves, because they're continuing to play this victimhood, these victim cards that really does them harm rather than good. Rather than saying that, that everybody, that there's no issue here and that it really doesn't make a difference who what colour the sports star is and so forth, they're going on this continual virtue signal of any minority group, really, whoever it is, it doesn't matter. And this is what happens here, people take it personally. What does that mean exactly? I mean, that implies that somehow that there's a connection there. Now, that's quite racist to imply there's a connection. I mean, a lot of people wouldn't think that that's the case. They'll think, well, an ape could be even used just as a derogatory term. It's just like calling someone a dog. Now, if you call someone a dog, that's just like, calling someone out that you don't like and calling them a name that would be seen as derogatory. Now, it doesn't mean that it's connected with race. But, for instance, if it's said to a person of a minority, like an Aboriginal, it's seen as a racist slur. If it's put to someone that's white, then it's nothing and swept under the rug. So there is a problem there that we need to see, that words are words and people are taking these things very seriously. And it really, this PC approach is destroying the game, destroying society as a whole.
And there's been so many posts there, the Adam Goods booing saga. There's been so many racist scandals in the AFL, which they've been keen to clamp down on. In 2016, a Port Adelaide supporter, she was publicly shamed because she threw a banana at Adelaide Indigenous footballer Eddie Betts, the implication being that she thought that he was a monkey and so wanted a banana. And so this is sort of logical leap that we've gone to. And it's gone to the comment, like, people on social media, like, say, like, offensive things all the time, but it's been picked up, like, comments that have, like, called Indigenous players monkeys. And there was even one where a Port Adelaide player, Paddy Ryder, underneath a photo of him, somebody put banana emojis, and that was a story as well. Just the AFL is wanting, like, even just comments, like, people make offensive comments on Facebook all the time, but, that's a AFL racism scandal now, this sort of overcorrection.
That's right, and, I mean, likewise, in that case, someone chucks a banana, that's because it was the closest thing they had that they wanted to chuck.
Yeah, I don't think they it was premeditated. They deliberately went to the football to throw a banana at an Indigenous player because they wanted to be racist.
Yeah, no, definitely not. I mean, it's quite common that if someone wants to throw something, they'll just throw something. A lot of the time it's a bottle.
I mean, she shouldn't have thrown it. Like, you shouldn't throw stuff at AFL players, but...
No, that's correct. But, I mean, it shouldn't be then used as a whole, let's virtue signal to minority groups and make this a racist case and continue. I mean, and this is the sad problem with this situation that we're having here. Rather than just calling it out like, oh, this was wrong because, it's a, violent thing to do to throw something at someone. But instead of using that, which is the common sense approach, they're naming race and going on this massive... attack and really does a lot of harm. So this is a sad situation. We're seeing it in sport more often, and I think it's something that people really need to go to watch the games for the game and not continue pushing these radical PC ideologies and trying to clamp down and attack people. It's sad, I mean, this is really bringing the game in disrepute.
We'll go back to the chronologging the Adam Goods booing saga, but because he, like, was so noble in standing up to racism, and we should also take a moment to shame Ian Maguire, who a few days later, they were versing Collingwood that night, the Sydney Swans, and so Eddie Maguire apologised to Adam Goods on behalf of the Collingwood Football Club for this offensive fan. But then a few days later on the radio, Eddie Maguire suggested that Adam Goods could promote King Kong, which, given what had just transpired, like, that is way worse than what the 13-year-old girl said. But because Eddie Maguire is so intertwined with AFL world, he wasn't disciplined as well. He just sort of gave a few press conferences where he was like, oh, I'm very sorry and I shouldn't have done this.
Yeah, I mean, either way, I don't think anything should have come from either situation, because it is words at the end of the day, and people should be free to be able to say such things, whether people like it or not. Now, in reference to Adam Goods, a lot of people would say that he was propagating, doing his war dance, that he was intimidating a lot of people.
Yeah, that was back in 2015. Yeah. We'll get to that in a moment, but we'll go back. Because of his standard racism, he was the 2014 Australian of the Year. And rewatching this documentary, it seemed he got sucked into that sort of Aboriginal grievance industry, because he was asked, like, is Australia Day racist? Is it Invasion Day? And he was sort of like, oh, I still like Australia Day, but I can understand why people are offensive. And then he also got sucked in by John Pilger's documentary, Utopia, which, well, despite the billions of dollars Australian successive governments have spent on Aboriginal welfare and advancement, it hasn't done anything. John Pilger, he presented this documentary that, oh, it's because our governments are still racist and, you know, secretly putting down Indigenous people. And Adam Goods was sucked in by this, saying, oh, you know, this documentary needs to be seen by more people. We need to acknowledge the shame and racism in our history. And there was also another bit in the documentary where he was asked by somebody from the BBC, how racist is Australia? And he was sort of goaded to sort of say, like, oh yes, Australia is such a terrible place. Like, because the more he said that Australians were racist, our history was racist, the more he got patted on the back by the Aboriginal grievance industry. And so he became in a bubble. And while he was enjoying the praise there, the AFL public, the people that pay his wages every week by going to the footy, buying merchandise, watching on TV, they were really resenting that he was basically saying that Australians were racist and discriminatory. And that's when the booing started, that they were really resentful of this.
Yeah. Well, obviously there was a stance that he decided to make there for his own, whether it be fame or whatever he wanted to achieve, and it backfired on him. But then when it was shoe on the other foot, he didn't like it, and then he then responded, like I said, with a war dance and so forth, and it just kept going on. But, I mean, it just seems to me that if there really was a racist culture and it was as bad as he said it was, then he wouldn't have even been able to be a football star in the first place. I mean, there was no way... There was no way that he would be able to be wealthy and be successful in his particular sport of choice if this was a racist nation that wouldn't have allowed such a thing to occur in the first place.
I mean, he was a player since 1990-91, two premierships with the Sydney Swans, two Brownlow medals. And we should also, we haven't pointed out yet that Adam Goods is only half Aboriginal. His father was Scottish. And so he made all these statements, I'm a proud Aboriginal man, yet there's this other half of his ancestry which is white. And so when he's saying all these like shameful things about white Australia, like, is he hating half of himself?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we see this ongoing all the time. I mean, every time you see someone that has a percentage of Aboriginal in them, and it seems to me that sometimes the less of a percent it is, the worse they are. If you get someone that is only 5% Aboriginal, they will virtue signal the hell out of that 5% and go on about how, you know, connected they are to that Aboriginal ethnicity or ancestry, so to speak, yet the whole other 95% of their white background is shit to them. And it makes you think sometimes, how can you reject a background or a culture or a race or whatever that has basically achieved more than anyone else ever has? I mean, being of European ancestry, I mean, very successful. If you're looking at, culture and racial backgrounds and whatever, you know, it could be stereotypical that you're looking at it. But, I mean, when you look at success and what, you know, inventions they've been able to come up with and what they've been able to achieve over the thousands of years, they've achieved more than anyone, yet they're shunned that past and only virtue signal on that, you know, the tribal group ancestry of that 5%. I mean, if you go to at least someone that is a full Aboriginal person of ancestry, they're very different. They're very different and a lot more, normally they're a lot more respectful as people. But when you always get these half Aboriginal or quarter or 1/8 or whatever, they tend to have this chip on their shoulder and they do everything they can to elevate their status of Aboriginal and downgrade their status of whatever percentage they are that are white. And normally they don't even look Aboriginal to start with. And the reason for that is because being Aboriginal is a privilege. It's something that, you know, they make more money on when it comes to Centrelink payments. I know a lot of people that are getting twice as much money just because of, you know, that 5% Aboriginal that they have in them. I mean, how that is able to exist, I don't understand, because it's such a discriminating sort of policy to have in place. But that is racism, really. I mean, when you have that, when you have jobs that are only available to Aboriginal people, I mean, how is that possible? How is that not racist? I mean, there's no way that somebody could advertise a job and say white people only apply, yet you could put Aboriginal people only. How can that possibly happen? I mean, that is privilege.
We've done so much through various governments to correct Aboriginal disadvantage, but you're right in what you say that there's, well, it's been proven that there's been a lot of rotting of this over the years. Now, the booing of Adam Goods, it reached its peak in 2015, and this is when the media started to really talk about it, and there was debate whether it was racist or not. It seemed to me, because AFL fans, they put up with a lot of social justice PC bullshit from the AFL hierarchy. I mean, they've had the Indigenous round for over a decade now with the Dreamtime game at the MCG. They have multicultural rounds celebrating all the different races that now play the game now, though that it sort of seems to be about promoting Muslims in the game, the multicultural round, it seems. And of course they've got the gay pride round now, where they had gender neutral bathrooms there, so they tolerate a lot, the AFL fans. But it just seemed Adam Goods pushed them too far, and they just cracked it. Like recently, how the AFL fans, they cracked it with the behavioural awareness officers who were telling them off for cheering too loudly. There is a point where the fans, it's like, I don't come to the football to be put down, be treated as a second class citizen, a dreg. No, I'm not going to cop this anymore. And so booing Adam Goods, it was, you know, we don't like, you know, how you're treating us, you know, how you're basically shitting on us as a society at whole. And so that's why you had so many boos. That's why, because AFL stadiums, they can fit, what, 40, 50, 60,000 people in it. There was a lot of boos there for that to get on TV.
Yeah, I mean, I just hate the fact that they are always politicising these events. I mean, just leave it as a sporting match, and that's what it is. That's what people want it to be. Let people boo the other side, and then the other side can boo them back. I mean, if you think that's bad, I mean, you should go and watch a derby match over in Europe in the soccer. I mean, and then you tell me or whatever. I mean, if they think that booing a player over here is such a scandal, I mean, overseas in some countries, they're setting fires in the stadiums, they're throwing bottles, they're going absolutely nuts. I mean, that is like what you would call scandalous. And over there, it's not even seen as a big issue because it's such a commonplace. Whereas here, just saying a couple of words, a boo, is such a big deal. And that's what's scary here. I mean, it's really scary when you compare it to other places that are a lot worse. I mean, with the PC garbage, like you said, the LGBT stuff that's pushed down people's throats, multicultural stuff. Another thing that you have to understand here is, even though they're catering to these minority groups, the minority groups are really small. I mean, how many Aboriginals in the country? 2%.
Well, there's a lot that play AFL. I mean, AFL has had a rich history of Indigenous players, and they are some of the best.
No, that's correct. That's correct. But I mean, all these little groups, the LGBT make about 3%. I mean, how many people in the LGBT crowd really get into the football?
Well, there's no male gay players, but there's a lot in the AFLW that are lesbians.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's fair enough. But I mean, like you said, it's such a small number that even though you're to cater and prop up these little groups of people, at the same time, then you're knocking a lot of people, a lot more people that would be against such a move. So you're trying to prop someone up, and then you're trying to piss other people off that are very loyal to your game. And when you do that, it's not a very good strategy because you're going to end up losing a lot more supporters and a lot more people that go watch the games than gaining. I mean, I really don't understand. I mean, I don't think someone that's gay at home on the TV is going to say, all of a sudden, I'm going to go and watch the footy now because they're pandering to me. I mean, I don't really think if they're going to be interested in football, they're going to go see it regardless, not because they're spewing some LGBT stuff or whatever on the TV, and likewise any other multicultural stuff either. People aren't going to go, oh yeah, I saw this on the news. It looks like the football is really catering to me now. All of a sudden, I'm going to enjoy the game and start watching it. I mean, that doesn't happen. You either like the sport or you don't like the sport. And by doing this, people that do like the sport and support it are going to get pissed off and not go to the games, and they're going to lose money. It's that simple.
When I watched the project analysis afterwards, because one of the arguments that was put forward that the booing was not racist because there's other Indigenous players who play the game and they don't get booed, but they all said, oh, it's because Adam Goode stood up for to racism, and it seems that the AFL fans, they only like Indigenous players if they, you know, shut up and just play football. Well, there's been plenty of Indigenous players who've done things for Aboriginal welfare and disadvantage, but you can do that. You can work in, you know, remote communities, like help young kids without accusing white people of being racist. It's possible to do one without the other.
Exactly. I mean, we see this in sports all the time, that at the end of the day, people aren't going to like assholes. As simple as that. It doesn't matter who you are, whether you're an Aboriginal, whether you're white. I mean, we see it in the tennis all the time. Quite popular sort of situations of tennis. People like Kyrgios, for instance, Tomic and stuff like that, that a lot of people hate them because of the way they act. And they're basically brats, you know, very immature, and their attitudes to the sport. It's not because, you know, they're of a particular background that they hate them. Whereas on the other foot, there's Aboriginal players that people absolutely love because they've got a good attitude to the game, like, for instance, Ash Barty. For instance, a lot of people support her, and they say quite the opposite of, say, people like Kyrgios, that she is someone that is very noble, very nice, and so forth, and a lot of people support her. And she's got an Aboriginal history, yet people really support her. You know what I mean? So it doesn't matter what background they come from. People look at the character, and the character determines whether someone will like you or not. I mean, a lot of people dislike Anthony Mundine, not because he's Aboriginal, but because a lot of people don't like his attitude, and he just happens to be Aboriginal. Likewise, we see a lot of people that are white that aren't very well liked either. So it quite simply is to do with the person's character, how they perform, and what their attitude is on when they play the particular sport, and even off field as well, what kind of life they live and how they speak and so forth. And there's a lot of factors in place, but that's what it's about. I mean, people don't dislike someone because they're of a particular background when it comes to sport. They support a particular team, a particular, you know, whether it be the country of Australia, whether it be a particular town and so forth. That's what they're supporting. And if you're a player in that team, then you're going to be supported unless you do something that makes them lose that support of you. That is how I see it, and I think most people see it that way too.
The other big story of the week was MasterChef judge George Calambaris, or should I say former MasterChef judge. He recently went before the Fair Work Commission, where it was found that his MADE establishment his chain of restaurants, they admitted to underpaying their employees $7.83 million in wages. This was to 515 employees over a decade. Now, he was fined $200,000 by the Fair Work Commission, which was called a contrition payment, and obviously has to pay back the underpayment. And the thing that struck me is, wow, you managed to underpay your workers to that tune. I mean, surely somebody would have picked something up. And the I'd say that the kitchen knives were out for George. After this, there were demands for him to be sacked from MasterChef, and it broke this week that all three judges on MasterChef, they would be departing after the show's series finale because Channel 10 decided to deny them a 40% pay rise from their million-plus salaries. And so, checking out the reaction on social media, everyone was like, oh, the irony, he underpaid his workers and now he's leaving Network 10 because he feels he's being underpaid.
Yeah, this is a sad case, but something that happens quite often. I mean, you only have to go speak to most people in hospitality and they'll say that this kind of activity is happening ongoing. And it seems like an industry that really stands out amongst most that is renowned for underpaying. I think people really need to, if people within the government and within particular, whether it be the ADO and whoever else wants to examine anyone, they should be going after hospitality industry more than anything, because that's the type of companies and the type of businesses that are doing this. I mean, I've spoken to people that are working in like takeaway shops, pizzerias and whatnot, and they're, you know, adults, 18, 19, 20 years old, and they told me that they're getting paid $10 an hour. You know, like, I mean, this isn't a joke here. I mean, $10 an hour, but because they're in TAFE or university or whatever, and they need the money, they end up doing the work. Now, I mean, really, $10 an hour is peanuts, especially with today's standards. And if they weren't living at home with their parents and they were trying to survive off that wage, there's no way they would be able to do it. And especially in that industry too, that you're not working full time. I mean, you're not working, 40-hour a week a lot of the time, unless you're in a cafe. But if you're in, say, a place that only serves dinner, then you're only doing 3-4 hours a night. So that makes it very difficult to sustain a wage in which you're able to survive and have that as a proper income. And especially when you're studying during the day, doing that for a little bit of side money on the night time, I don't understand how people are going to be able to live off that, especially with the high cost of living pressures that they're suffering. So this is something that really needs to be sorted here. I mean, you could argue that wages are either too low or too high, but that isn't the issue. The issue is that people are getting paid ridiculous amounts here, ridiculous of shortage amounts. And I mean, this is not even like a couple of dollars under. This is like, you know, half wages that are half the minimum wage, for instance. So that's really low. That is unsustainable. It's something that people can't live off, and that's what makes it such a big deal.
Well, as it's termed wage theft, it's become quite a common practice, or as you mentioned, in the hospitality industry, but it's gained a lot of attention. And now the Morrison government, you know, the alleged Liberal and National Party of workplace reform and labour deregulation, they actually want to increase the penalties for wage theft and underpayment. They actually want to make deliberate, systematic wage theft a criminal offence, where it's just a civil one. At the moment, it seems that the coalition, they're still spooked by their work choices loss, and that the union movement is just so aggressive these days. They've got their Change the Rules campaign to try and change the independent contracting arrangements of the gig economy. So they definitely feel that to remain in power, especially at a time when when real wages aren't rising, that they've sort of got to look like they're tough on these employers and on the side of the workers, but they're just not as socialist and class warfare as the Labour Party is.
Yeah, I mean, I would actually argue that it's not wages that is the problem here. It's the cost of living that's the main problem, because no matter how high the wage goes, the cost of living just goes a lot higher than that wage increase. So at the end of the day, I mean, if somebody was on a low wage, but it was just like it was back in our parents' time where the cost of living was so low and a lot more affordable, then it would be a case where people would be able to manage to live off so much less. So it wouldn't be such an issue. But the problem being today is that even at a minimum wage, that people are struggling on that, given the amount of, especially in the hospitality industry, because the hours that they're doing is small amount of hours, and they aren't able to be able to make enough within the week to be able to survive off it as income. And many of them live with their parents, for instance, and that's why they're able to do it, because they've got that support. They don't have to pay rent. And I think that's where the bulk of payments would normally go if they were living on their own. But likewise, I mean, fair enough, somebody can conversate with an employee. They could come to an arrangement, and that's why there's a minimum wage, for instance. And instead of even paying a big rate, they can pay a rate that is just enough for them to basically cope. But nevertheless, when they're getting paid half the minimum wage, then there's got to be a line to be drawn there. I mean, there has to be a way where you can determine, okay, this is just taking advantage of people that are vulnerable, that really in a situation where they need a little bit of pocket money, and you know, they're just basically greedy in how they're using them for that service, and they have really not much of a choice because of the situation that they've been put in. I mean, you can all you like talk about, you know, agreements and so forth, and I agree that employers and employees can come to arrangements when it comes to pay. But likewise, I don't mind pay being low, but that's if the cost of living was at a reasonable rate of standard two, which people would be able to then, like in previous time, be able to afford the daily things that they need. And I'm not talking about going and buying big screen TVs and all that. I'm just talking about the basics in food and, you know, rent and that sort of thing. And if people are able to do that on a minimum, then that would be fine. That would be perfectly fine, I think. I think that's what really needs to be spoken about.
I'm definitely in favour of more flexibility when it comes to workplace arrangements. And the Kalambaras case, it has opened up a debate around that. But the way that I come in it on his case is that the law is the law. It has to be applied equally. And he clearly broke the law and underpaid his employees, and so he's got to pay the price for that. But definitely, it's as we mentioned, the hospitality industry, this is rampant. It's not because of greedy employers per se, it's because the employers are under a lot of pressure to make ends meet themselves, and so they cut corners and try and get away with things. I mean, being an employer is not as easy as you think, and this is what was happening with the 7-Eleven underpayment scandal, is that the franchises were coming under a lot of cost pressures, and so that's how they found a way to cut corners as well. So it's not a simple oppressor and oppressee. There's a combination of factors, but yeah, the high cost of living, high cost of supplies, which is pushed up by things such as energy prices, and just the cost of regulations pushing up everything. That's I think what we need to look at, why things are so expensive in the first place, which is pushing everything up and pushing people to the brink.
Yeah, well, that's the pattern there. So it's like a conveyor belt. I mean, the high price of living keeps going up and up, and that's why then they have to push the wage up to be able to meet that. The wage only goes slowly up when compared to the cost of living. And like you said also on the employer, that their supplies are going up in cost too, which then makes them feel like they have to cut corners to make a reasonable amount of money. And I've seen this in small businesses all the time, and particularly, unfortunately, it is with the hospitality industry, because they're only working a minimal amount of hours a day, rather than a lot of them working full days. They're only doing, say, a dinner service. A lot of them are like that, or a lunch and a dinner, which is only a multiple amount of hours per sitting. So, I mean, they're not really, the people working aren't getting the amount of hours needed to make a reasonable amount of income. Even if it was a good wage, it's still not much at the end of the week when you count it up. And the people that are running the show are paying a lot more for their food and for whatever else they're purchasing, and that makes it hard on them too. I mean, I see this when I go to the shops. I'm doing my groceries. Groceries are going up skyrocket. I mean, just recently, a popular cheese, I buy Parmesan cheese, used to be $16 a kilo, now it's $23 a kilo. It's gone up $5-$6 overnight. Bang, just overnight. And no matter what place I go to, I've went to several places, all the same. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that I'm seeing here. And, you know, that's a massive hike, just $5 or $6 a kilo, just up like that. I mean, I've also spoken to people that are butchers, and they're saying the same thing is happening to meat, that they have to put their prices up because of the cost that they are. So at the end of the day, everybody is feeling it, you know, and all it takes is one person to increase cost, and then 10 other people under them then have to increase their costs because of the conveyor belt that occurs. And everybody ends up suffering in the end, you know. Like, I mean, this is what makes it very difficult. So I'm just hoping that this situation here, that people are able to be a lot more careful, that they do follow the rules and the laws. I know someone on the radio the other day was saying that the award system is very difficult because there was about 20 different awards. And it made it very confusing to a lot of employers. That could be the case. But nevertheless, people have to make sure they're doing the right thing by the law and by their worker. At the same time, the worker obviously, you know, has to understand what the business is going through too. And the business has to do their best considering the circumstance and somehow strike a balance here. They have to obviously be able to afford everything and make money on the side when it comes to what they're purchasing their supplies for and so forth, and then also give to their employees a reasonable amount too. So it's a balancing act, really, to make sure that everything goes accordingly.
Well, I think the Kalambara wages scandal, it's certainly a microcosm of the economic problems that we're facing in Australia. Well, as always, we covered a lot of ground tonight. Hope we've given our audience all the details they need to digest these major stories. Thank you again, Damien, for joining me, and we'll be back for the next round of news next week.
No, good for having me, Tim, and I'll look forward to it.
And that's the show for today. As you'll have noticed this week, Waves is back to being produced at least twice a week, so expect another show in the coming days. There is plenty of other content that we are producing, such as Detonation by my colleague Steele Archer, featured on the Unshackled's YouTube channel. There is also, of course, the joint production we have with the XYZ and Rational Rise, The Uncuckables, live every Thursday at 8:30 p.m. Melbourne time. Make sure you subscribe to the Uncuckables dedicated YouTube channel, which continues to grow, to make sure you are notified when the show goes live or to catch up on previous shows. I would like to encourage you all again to bake free from big tech's information manipulation. So use DuckDuckGo for your search results, InfoGalactic for your information needs, and interact with others on free speech social media where you don't have to worry about being banned. The Unshackled has a presence on all of these. We're on gab.com/theunshackled. We're also on minds.com/the_unshackled. We're also on miwi.com/p/theunshackled. And we also have our growing Telegram channel on the popular encrypted messaging service, which all the alt media people are on. You can find us there at t.me/theunshackled. Remember that we cannot bring you all of this alternative content without your financial support. We are on patreon.com/theunshackled and paypal.me/theunshackled. We also have our premium membership option on our website, theunshackled.net/membership, and our web donation form at theunshackled.net/donate. We are also on subscribestar.com/theunshackled. So thanks once again for your company, and we'll see you next show.
Thanks for tuning in to The Unshackled Waves. Please visit theunshackledwaves.net for all the ways to subscribe and follow the show. Don't forget to pick up your free ebook at theunshackledbattlefield.net and keep checking out theunshackled.net for all the latest news and commentary.